Well, good morning. Okay, we'll try one more time. Good morning.
Good morning.
I hope that you have had a restful and relaxing, refreshing spring break. And if you're sitting there thinking, I don't get a spring break anymore, well, I still hope that you are feeling refreshed and relaxed from this weekend. We got home Friday from a little trip, and I stumbled upon this story that I thought was very timely for the topic that we're going to talk about this morning. There is a curbside porter at an airport, and he is trying to check the bags of a man who's getting ready to fly, and evidently he's not doing it to the man's expectations, and so the man is criticizing him and belittling him and giving him a hard time the entire time. And the curbside porter doesn't seem to be ruffled at all. Like, he doesn't seem to be frustrated or anything. And finally they get it all done, and the guy goes into the airport. And a woman who's kind of witnessed the whole thing comes up to the curbside porter and says, how do you put up with that kind of verbal abuse? And he goes, oh, that's easy. That guy, he's going to New York, but I'm sending his bags to Brazil. So this morning, we're going to continue our series on vulnerability. And as that story hints, we're going to talk about anger. And the curbside porter gives us one way of dealing with frustration with people, right? Before we do that, though, I want to talk about something that I feel like is true for all emotions. All things that when we feel something, sometimes we need to be reminded. And I feel like in 20 years of ministry, I've had to say this dozens of times to people. So let me just start with two things that are true always for when we feel things. One, God is big enough to handle whatever emotion we're feeling. Vulnerability means that we have permission to feel what we're naturally feeling. For some reason, we seem to think that the negative emotions, like doubts and sadness, depression, fear, anger, that those are taboo, those are off limits. But the truth is, God is not surprised by any of those emotions, and he does not want to reject us when we're feeling them. He wants us to embrace them and to recognize them, because emotions aren't bad. They are just a part of being human. It's how we're wired. And we seem to be okay with joy and love and exuberance, the positive ones, but the negative ones seem to be a challenge for us. And here's the thing, a negative emotion doesn't mean it's a bad emotion. It doesn't feel good, but it doesn't mean it's a bad thing to feel. Jesus allowed himself to be vulnerable. He cried, he felt fear, he rejoiced, he loved, he experienced loneliness, anguish, yes, and even anger. We'll talk about that later. A quick reading of one of the Gospels, it shows that he was not an unfeeling shell of a human being. But because we live in a culture that tells us to be in control, to look like we've always got it together, it discourages the vulnerability that's required for us to share emotions that sometimes don't look like we're in control. And so we feel weak, and then we don't share them, we stuff them. In the movie A League of Their Own, like way back 1992, Tom Hanks plays Jimmy Dugan, who is coaching a pro women's baseball team during World War II. And he's yelling at the right fielder, Evelyn Gardner, for throwing the ball home when the team had a 2-run lead. Well, what does she do when he starts yelling at her? He walks away and she starts to cry. And he turns around and he looks at her and he says, "Are you crying?" And then you know what he says next. He goes, "There's no crying in baseball." Well, you know what? I think that we assume that because we follow Jesus, there's this unspoken rule that there's no doubting, there's no crying, there's no getting angry in the Christian life. Guess what? You and I know that's not true, right? One of those probably happened this week. So, of course, it doesn't feel good to feel bad, but if this Jesus, who we believe had both the fullness of God and the fullness of being a human being, residing in his heart and his mind and his cells, if he expressed the full range of human emotions, then don't you think we can certainly have permission to express ours? Here's what we need to understand. It's not actually anger that trips us up. It's how we navigate it. For example, evidently I have a bit of a temper. It takes a while to get there. It doesn't happen often. But when it does, I've been told it's memorable. My sister can tell you about the time that I slammed a brush down in the bathroom when we were teenagers, and it shattered into a million little pieces. Her eyes were like this. The students of Redeemer Covenant Church 15 years ago lovingly reminisce about that one time that Denise got mad in D.C. on a mission trip. And I've been known to hit a wall a few times with my hand because I was so angry and I just needed to release some emotion. Let me just tell you, I don't recommend that because it doesn't release a whole lot of emotion, but I definitely get a red, swollen hand from it. So I don't recommend that. Try a pillow. Move to a pillow. So does this Jesus, who is fully God and fully human, does he have anything to say about my anger issues or yours? I'm so glad you asked, because yes, he does. In Matthew 5, during his Sermon on the Mount, pretty early in his Sermon on the Mount, Jesus says this. You've heard that it was said to the people long ago, you shall not murder, and anyone who murders will be subject to judgment. But I tell you that anyone who is angry with a brother or sister will be subject to judgment. And again, anyone who says to a brother or sister, Raca, is answerable to the court. And anyone who says, you fool, will be in danger of the fire of hell. Yikes. But he goes on. Therefore, if you are offering your gift at the altar and there remember that your brother or sister has something against you, and I just want to parenthetically say, I'm pretty sure that implies if we realize we have something against a brother or a sister, I think it's reciprocal. Leave your gift there in front of the altar. First, go and be reconciled to them. Then come and offer your gift. Settle matters quickly with your adversary who is taking you to court. Do it while you are still together on the way, or your adversary may hand you over to the judge, and the judge may hand you over to the officer, and you may be thrown in prison. Truly, I tell you, you will not get out until you have paid the last penny. Wow. All because I threw a temper tantrum. He says some really strong stuff there. Why? Is he using hyperbole? Is he exaggerating to make a point? Or is Jesus trying to reframe how we acknowledge and navigate our anger? First, he does something so surprising. He compares anger to murder. Really? Why say something so provocative? Does he really see anger and murder as the same? I don't think he sees them as complete equivalents. Not in every sense of the comparison, but I do think he is telling us, yes, they share something in common. And here it is. God is as serious about our anger issues as he is about physical violence against one another. It means just as much to him that I deal with my anger that I have towards you as it does someone who is willing to take a life. See, we tend to have a hierarchy of sins. Some are really obvious and awful. Of course they're terrible. Of course you shouldn't do that. Of course that's destructive. But then others go a little unnoticed and aren't checked as well because they're not as immediately dramatic. But God looks at us and he says, you know what? You are accountable to me for the act of taking a person's life. And then we all say in our minds, yeah, but I would never do that. And, he says, you are also accountable to me in how you handle your anger towards another person. Both are very, very important to me. Next, in this message he's giving on the mountain, Jesus is saying, when our anger tells someone they are worthless, we're in trouble. See, the word raca in that day was a phrase of pure contempt for someone. Like, just the most contemptuous thing you could say to someone. It could mean, oh, you're such an empty one. You are worthless. You're a fool. You're a numbskull. And see, God says, wait a second. Humans are made in the imago Dei, the image and likeness of God. We have something special. We have an identity within us that was God-breathed, an essence that reflects who he is to the world. And he does not like it when we discount that in someone else, when we look at them as if they might as well not exist, because he wants them to reflect the imago Dei. And so when we say that somebody is beneath us, or we look at them and go, gosh, I wish you weren't even here, with the way we treat them, we're flying in the face of God's, some of his first words about humanity. It's important to him that we value and honor people, even in our anger. Something else that Jesus is talking about here. Practicing vulnerability in our anger means being willing to go make things right sooner than later. Being the one to initiate reconciliation means that we have to swallow all of our pride in one big gulp. We have to let go of control. We have to let go of that power we have to hold a grudge against someone. It gives us strength, and like we feel powerful when we know that we can be mad at them and hold that against them. There's something about that. And God says, let it go, because that's what Jesus did, who being in very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be used to his own advantage. Rather, he made himself nothing by taking on the very nature of a servant and humbled himself, all so that we could be reconciled, brought home to God. If he was willing to be so vulnerable on our behalf for us, he calls us to take up our cross of forgiveness and offer that to those who have angered us and wronged us. Last thing, there is a relational cost to allowing our anger to fester. Love that word, fester. I thought it'd be fun to look at some synonyms to the word fester, because it's kind of colorful. Here they are: rot, deteriorate, decay, fall apart, seethe. And then words that are listed as the opposite, the antonyms, straight from the thesaurus: grow, purify, heal, flourish, build, strengthen. See, the bottom line is that when we allow anger to go unchecked in our lives, it leads to destructive things. Decay in our hearts, deteriorating relationships with the people that we're angry at, situations that fall apart, anger that continues to seethe within us. I think that's why Jesus references the fire of hell, which when he says that, he's talking about a place called Gehenna. It's just outside Jerusalem. It's where all the waste is burnt up outside the city. He's saying, listen, when you keep anger in your heart, it becomes this wasteful, destructive path that leads you nowhere. It's like hell on earth, because you're miserable. You're miserable. So when we do check our anger in a healthy way, things like growth happens in us as a human being. Our hearts are purified. Our relationships with other people are healed. People that we've been angry at are able to flourish. Bridges are built, and people are strengthened. Doctors in Coral Gables, Florida, compared the efficiency of the heart pumping, or the heart's pumping action, in 18 men who had coronary artery disease to 9 healthy men. And each of the participants went through a physical stress test on an exercise bike and 3 mental stress tests. One was doing math problems in their head, giving a short speech to defend themselves against the accusation of shoplifting, and recalling a moment recently that they had been angry. of all four tests, the one about recalling the memory of anger reduced the amount of blood that the heart pumps to the body tissues more than any other test. Literally, their body could not work as healthily and efficiently because they were angry. I love it when science and faith meet up and say, see, this is not the way to live. It's not the way to live to stay angry. So you may be asking, when was it okay for Jesus to be angry? Can we talk about that? Again, so glad you asked, because yes, there's some good ones, some memorable ones. In Matthew 16, Jesus gets annoyed with his disciples for the umpteenth time because he's trying to have a teachable moment with them. And they go on what you've probably heard me talk about before as an adventure and missing the point. So they've just fed, for the second time, several thousand people with a few loaves of bread and fish. Then the religious leaders from the temple come to him and they demand that he prove himself with a miraculous sign. I'm sure he's thinking, did you miss the bread and the fish just back there? We just did something pretty big. But they wanted right now, show us what, who do you think you are? Show us what you can do. And so when he gets done with that confrontation with them, they all get in the boat, the disciples and Jesus. But the disciples forgot bread. I guess it was gonna be a long enough trip, they were supposed to bring food, but they forgot. Jesus sees a moment, like we have the luxury of seeing the whole picture, right? So he's got this whole we've fed thousands of people thing, and then he had this really messy altercation with the priests, and now he's with the disciples in the boat. And he says, guys, you gotta really be careful about the yeast of the Pharisees. Be very careful because there's something really unhealthy growing there, something that is destructive and bad, and you need to be careful. Now we know he's talking about their hearts. He's saying, don't listen to some of those very damaging things that they are saying and the attitudes that they have. But the disciples go, wait, are you upset because we forgot to bring bread? Did we forget the bread? We must have forgot the bread. I love that. Cue Jesus rolling his eyes and going, oh, what am I going to do with these people? That's actually not in scripture. That's just my interpretation of what happened next. So he's trying to help them understand something and they miss it. Then in Matthew 21, he has a banner day. In 24 hours, approximately, he clears the temple, he curses a fig tree, and has another little confrontation with the religious leaders. All very purposeful demonstrations of his anger. So in the temple, that's where people are supposed to be able to come and pray and encounter God and find acceptance and a place of peace. But instead, they come, and because they're getting ready for the Passover, it is a marketplace of sales and monetary exchanges. And it's disproportionately targeting the poor because they are the ones that can't afford a sacrifice, so they have to buy doves. And so Jesus is pretty angry because this place has distracted from the purpose. It's devalued people that God loves dearly and wants to encounter him. And it's just completely taken the attention away from what the purpose of the temple was. He takes issue with that when we get in the way of people seeing and hearing from God. That bothers him and it makes him angry. Then he walks to Bethany for the evening and he's coming back, and in the morning he's hungry. I think I'll have a fig off of this fig tree, but guess what? It's a beautiful tree. It's a beautiful, lush tree, no fruit. Now, do you think the Savior of the world, like God incarnate, is really angry at a tree? Probably not. But what an incredible picture of what he sees happening around him. He's had all these instances with temple leaders and folks who are questioning and they're missing the point. And he says, wow, there's so much here, but there's no fruit. There's nothing life-giving happening. You who are supposed to be leading people into the presence of God, into relationship and covenant with Him, you have so much to offer, but people are not finding life in what you are doing. He takes issue when we have so much to offer, when we've been blessed with so much, when we understand so much, when we have so much ability to help and we don't bear any fruit. That bothers Him and it makes Him angry. Then He finally tops it off with the confrontation with the priests and the religious leaders. So they come to Him again and they look at Him and they go, "Listen, mister, you came into the temple yesterday, you turned things upside down, you created all kinds of chaos, you've stirred things up, and we've got a well-running machine here, and you are making a mess of things. And who do you think you are coming in and doing what you did? Who gives you the authority to challenge us and what we're doing in the temple? And for you to heal all those people, who gives you that authority?" And Jesus goes, "Okay, I'll play your game. Tell you what, you answer my question, I'll answer yours." I can just hear it. He's kind of challenging them. I can sense that He's angry, but He's gonna say, let's play this game. I have a question for you. Answer it and I'll answer your question. But His question for them about John the Baptist is kind of a trick question, because however they answer it will reveal how they feel about Him and what they believe about Him. It's going to cause them to have to take a side, and they know that because they really know deep in their hearts what's going on here, that something different is at work, but they are not willing to accept it. And so they look at Jesus and they go, "We don't know." They dodge the question. "We have no clue." And Jesus says, "Okay, then I'm not going to answer your question." Just kind of leaves the tension hanging in the air. A few minutes later, later on, he does try to share another story in hopes that they will listen, understand, because these are situations where Jesus' annoyance and His anger is pointing people to needed change. It's not about lashing out. It's this deep and desperate desire for them to see God's salvation clearly, even when they're being slow to understand and they're being selfish with what they have and stubborn in their hearts. He's saying to them, "See me. See God at work in me and see what happens. Just open your eyes and see me." And He's so frustrated that they don't see. So He's angry. Aristotle says anyone can become angry. That's easy. But to be angry with the right person, to the right degree, at the right time, for the right purpose, and in the right way, that's not easy. Jesus understood where His anger was appropriate and where it needed to be directed and how it needed to be navigated. And if I just want to take 60 seconds here and talk about something that I think if we all did this, this message would be a rollicking success. If we all committed to this. If you have a personal phone or personal technology device on you, would you please just hold it up? Okay, so like our fourth graders have these, right? We can talk about whether or not a fourth grader should have it later, but our fourth graders have these, okay? So here's my anger. Here's my phone, my iPhone. My anger does not, this is not the proper forum to express my anger, ever, ever. We cannot text, Facebook, tweet, Snapchat, group me our way into reconciliation with people. We will say things here and type words here that we would never have the courage to say to somebody's face. Jesus didn't have the luxury. He did not have the luxury, and it's really not a luxury, but did not have the luxury to text somebody, "Mr. Pharisee, you really ticked me off today." He looked at their face, made eye contact with them. They heard His voice, and that is where expressing healthy and appropriate anger began. We cannot, when we're angry at somebody or we feel vigilant about a certain political stance, we cannot do it here. And if we all would just stop doing that, I really feel like it would change our community. Maybe it would catch on. Because see, I think this is the Gehenna of destructive relationships. I use it every day. It's like an appendage for me too. But when we use it to navigate anger in an unhealthy way, it poisons us and it poisons human relationships and forgets this thing does not know that you are made in the Imago Dei, but I do. So let's just stop with that and see what happens. I want to close this morning with my own personal story. You know, we're talking about vulnerability, so it'd be good if those of us that are talking about it would express a little bit of that ourselves. And so what I want you to keep in mind is that it's important to recognize when our anger is not really about being angry at all. When Garrison was about 2, by the way, Gary gave me permission to share this story. When Garrison was about 2, we had an argument. And I said some really mean things. And then ran up the stairs, I think, and sat down on the steps, and then cried. So I got 2 in that day, anger and crying. And he followed me up and sat next to me on the stairs, and he looked at me and he said, "Who are you? And what have you done with my wife?" Because even with knowing that I have a bit of a temper when my fuse blows, he knew that what was happening was way out of character for me. I was angry, but I wasn't angry at Gary. And actually, the anger was more about being hurt. I can't even remember what we argued about, but I do remember the sense of loss I felt. I had just gone off staff here at Redeemer, really missed ministry. Wasn't sure what was next, didn't feel like I had control. I like to have control. I felt very lost and lonely, and it came out as anger. But those were the emotions and struggles that I needed to identify so that I could address them. Because hurt people, sometimes we show our hurt because we're angry, but then we hurt other people. So think about, be aware that sometimes when that anger rushes out, ask yourself the question, is this about being angry? Or is this about something else? As we close this morning, I want to show you a picture. This is a helleborus plant. I have a few of these in my yard. I love these plants because just when I'm so tired of cold weather, these babies bloom. They are evergreen plants that bloom near the middle or end of winter, not spring. They bloom before spring ever gets here. And their strength is that their blooms can be vulnerable to the harsh realities of late winter storms and still flourish under a blanket of snow until spring arrives. 2 Corinthians 5:18 says, "All of this is from God, the newness that we experience, who reconciled us to himself through Christ and gave us the ministry of reconciliation." See, forgiveness, dealing with our anger in a healthy way, reconciliation means renewing, starting over, even when we are covered with negative emotions that we need to navigate in a healthy way. And when we find ourselves blanketed in anger, remember that our strength is found when we are vulnerable enough to go and seek renewal, restoration, and reconciliation with others. Would you pray with me? God, we ask that you would keep in us a reminder that even in the wintry days of our lives, when stuff is not feeling good, when we are angry or sad or depressed, that renewal is coming, and renewal can be found, and we can pursue it. Help us to not let anger get a foothold in our life. Help us to be able to own it and embrace it, but then to address it and be reconciled to those with whom we are angry. In your name, amen.